Thank you, Your Honor. May it please the Court, my name is Dave Rowland and I represent Ms. Natalie Val, a candidate to represent the 78th Representative District in the House of Representatives. Your Honors, I believe that we have adequately addressed the questions of standing and the preservation of constitutional challenges in the briefs. So unless there are specific questions addressed at those issues, I'd like to go directly to the substantive issues raised in this case.
Counsel, what is it you want us to do?
Your Honor, I would like you to reverse the trial court's judgment and issue an order requiring Natalie Val's name to remain on the ballot after the Court of Appeals Western District ruled in Val's favor. They issued a mandate that required her name to be put on the ballot, so her name is currently on the ballot. We would like for her name to remain.
Has anybody suggested that they're going to take it off?
Your Honor, if you rule in favor of the Secretary of State's office, it's not a question of whether her name would be removed, but rather that her candidacy would be ended. Under this circumstance, Missouri statutes make clear that her name would remain on the ballot if the votes cast in her favor are more than are cast for her opponent in the primary election. Then there would be treated the situation would be treated as if there was a vacancy for the general election, and Missouri law also provides for how vacancies may be filled in circumstances like that.
If she's disqualified.
If this court rules that she's disqualified.
If we didn't do anything at all.
I'm sorry, Your Honor?
If we take no action at all, it sounds to me like you've gotten everything you wanted. She's on the ballot.
That's true, Your Honor. We did ask for a declaratory judgment. And we would like this court to issue a declaratory judgment.
But that was as a basis for ordering her to be on the ballot, right? That was the declaration you wanted, was that because of that, then she has to be on the ballot. And she's on the ballot. So you have nothing left to win.
That's correct. Well, Your Honor, if it was up to us, we wouldn't be here today.
It's your appeal.
It is our appeal, Your Honor. Having won at the Court of Appeals, we were content to let that stand. The Attorney General's office asked this court to take transfer. That's why we're here. We were perfectly content with the correct judgment by the Court of Appeals.
What if the Court of Appeals decision that you had standing had done just that, said you had standing and reversed the trial court's decision on standing and sent it back to the trial court?
The court could have theoretically remanded. However, given that the issue was resolved as a motion for judgment on the pleadings, appellate courts are permitted to enter the judgments that are appropriate in the wake of a trial court judgment on the pleadings. And we cited a case that holds that effect, and that's what the Court of Appeals did. We think correctly, particularly because of the tight timelines. If this case had been remanded to the trial court, Ms. Val's status as a candidate would still have been in some question, pending the outcome of the trial court's proceedings on remand. So we do believe that the court correctly decided to go ahead and resolve the matter definitively so that there would be no more ambiguity and the election process could proceed without the turmoil and question that would have been involved with the remand. We do ask this court to resolve the issue definitively to the extent that there would be any underlying issues that would yet to be resolved. A remand might be appropriate, but we don't believe that that is actually the case. We believe that the court can resolve the legal issues definitively, and there's no need for further proceedings at the trial.
So getting to those issues, what does the statute mean by the words entitled to be voted for at the primary election?
Well, Your Honor, as we pointed out in our substitute brief, this simply acknowledges that the General Assembly has given authority to at least two different entities to make determinations prior to an election.
It doesn't say unless disqualified by the Department of Revenue or whatever the other.
That's true. It doesn't explicitly say that. It also does not explicitly say the Secretary of State can make whatever judgments he chooses about the qualifications of a candidate.
But would your interpretation be exactly the same were that language not in the statute?
I'm not sure I understand your question, Your Honor.
I'm trying to figure out, we have a rule of construction that all the words in the statute we try to give some meaning to, so they're not simply there for no purpose. And as I'm understanding your position here, It's the statute would mean the exact same things were that phrase not there. Entitled to be voted for at the primary election. If that's not the case, are you saying that you in the absence of that phrase, the secretary would have to certify your client for election even if she'd been declared unqualified by the Department of Revenue and others? What does this add under your interpretation?
Your Honor, my understanding is that when the General Assembly passed the election reforms in 1977, they made clear that courts would have the authority to pass judgment on candidates' qualifications. Prior to that, courts had assumed they had that authority. It actually was not clear. And if you look at the decisions dealing with these sorts of challenges running from the early 1900s to about the middle of the century, several times the courts said, well, we're not really sure if we have this authority or not. So by passing the Comprehensive Election Reform of 1977, the General Assembly made clear the courts have jurisdiction to evaluate these challenges in a very clearly defined and established way. Also, the Department of Revenue has authority under certain circumstances to pass judgment on a candidate's at least eligibility for the ballot. The language added in there and eligible to be voted on, I believe, is a reflection of the fact that the General Assembly was adding these new provisions, explicitly giving the Department of Revenue an opportunity to declare a candidate ineligible for election, giving the courts an explicit authority to declare a candidate ineligible for election.
Now, in King v. Welch, argued by Judge Crane at the time, that was 1972. So would the 1977 revisions then take the authority? Welch was the election commissioner in San Luis County, and Buzz King wanted Kit Bond's name taken off the ballot because the assertion was that Kit Bond was not a resident of the state of Missouri at the requisite time needed to run for governor. So they didn't go to the Secretary of State. They went figuring that San Luis County has a lot of voters. They can get his name off of San Luis County's ballot. Buzz King's then the representative of the Republican Party. So with Welch not having the authority at all to deal with these issues, does it do away with King v. Welch?
I think it certainly limits the scope of the ruling there. The fact of the matter is when the legislature establish these clear procedures for how you would handle challenges to a candidate's eligibility. Just as with any section of the statute of the legislature that is passed after something has been decided previously, it will necessarily impact the outcome in the courts within the scope of the statute that is passed. So I apologize. I can't remember the details of the holding in the Welch case.
The courts did take authority over the case and issued an opinion, a 5-2 opinion, on the case saying that the governor and Senator Bond, Hart always belonged to Missouri. He always, Covington and Burling testified that he spoke with him and said, and Kit Bond said, I always meant to come back to Missouri.
Well, yes, Your Honor, and in many cases, the court assumed the authority to rule on these questions of candidates' eligibility. It's just that when Section 115.526 was passed, it clarified the scope of the sorts of challenges that courts could hear. Now, if the challenge to the senator's eligibility to run for governor fell outside of the scope of what would become Chapter 115.526, I would argue that at that point, no longer do the courts have authority to hear that question. Again, Your Honor, I apologize for not being as aware of the holding in that case to speak more definitively on it. Perhaps additional briefing might be useful if the court wishes to rule in that area.
Counsel, I want to understand your position exactly because I'm not sure I fully comprehend what authority you think the Secretary does have. What if a declaration of candidacy were filed that showed the person was not of adequate age or lived in a county different than the one in which they were needed to live in order to run for that office and so forth, does the secretary have authority to refuse to accept that or refuse to pass it on?
The secretary and this court has held previously that the secretary has authority to ensure technical compliance with of the form of the Declaration of Candidacy. So if something about the form of the Declaration of Candidacy is inadequate or out of compliance with what the laws require, the secretary can refuse to file that.
And if it shows you're not qualified, that means you can refuse to file it? Or if it's adequate as to form, but it simply shows?
Arguably, the secretary can say, we believe that this doesn't comply, we're going to refuse to file. And at that point, the candidate or would-be candidate could file a mandamus action to try and have their name added to the ballot. But once the secretary has accepted a filing, they no longer have any sort of discretion
Where is that in the statute? There's this difference between before and after.
The statute doesn't anticipate what happens prior to the filing of a declaration of candidacy, but this court's decision in State Ex Rel Ferris versus Roach does address that.
Mm-hmm.
It mentions the possibility that the secretary could have refused to accept a declaration of candidacy if it felt like it was not in the proper form.
Would it be your position that had the secretary looked at the records and seen that this candidate had not been registered to vote for 2 years, they could have refused to accept the application, the declaration for filing?
I will not say that the secretary absolutely could have, that he would have been legally justified in doing so. Mm-hmm. He could have done it. Now, that does not say that he would be legally justified
right. In
doing it. The question of whether he was legally justified then could have been raised in an action by the candidate. But that's not the case that we have in front of us. The case in front of us, the secretary did accept the filing. And pursuant to this court's binding precedent in State Ex Rel Ferris versus Roach, at that point, he no longer has discretion as to how he handles this declaration of candidacy. If the secretary has questions about the truthfulness of something in a declaration, they now have the option of going to a candidate's opponent and saying, hey, we think this may be incorrect, or we think that this may not qualify the candidate may not qualify. But the secretary themselves don't have the authority to make a unilateral judgment on their own part. That question, the question of a candidate's qualifications, is for the courts to decide. And in fact, no one.
Well, our courts have said that being registered to vote is a qualification. So, what judgment was the secretary making here? I know you say that's wrong and it's unconstitutional, but they say that the 2-year registration requirement is. A number of cases are cited in the briefs that say that.
Well, that's never been an issue. The secretary does not have authority to say, well, even though I've accepted this declaration of candidacy, I'm not going to certify their name for the ballot. That's discretion that the Secretary of State does not have. The Missouri statutes do not give the Secretary that authority, and the Secretary of State only has the authority granted by statute.
Does the Declaration of Candidacy form indicate one way or the other? Does it make an affirmative statement one way or the other as to how long somebody's been a registered voter?
No, it does not. No, the statement required is the candidate certifies or swears that if elected, they will qualify. And, Your Honors, as we made clear in our briefing, Ms. Vowell does, in fact, believe that she meets every legitimate qualification to serve in the legislature. If this court decides that the statutes do give the secretary authority to make his own judgments as opposed to the court's judgments about a candidate's qualifications, then we have to address the First Amendment issue. And the First Amendment question is, can Missouri impose a penalty for exercising a constitutionally protected political protest? That's what Ms. Vowell did in this case. Although the secretary has tried to suggest that that's not the case, it's firmly established.
What if your client didn't believe in paying taxes, thought they were improper, and that was her First Amendment right to say that she didn't believe in it, she thought, and to not pay them, and yet that's a requirement?
I'm not aware of a U.S. Supreme Court's case saying that that is constitutionally protected, but the Buckley case.
But you're saying you have a First Amendment right to do that, to if you disagree with a requirement, a statutory requirement, nonetheless to disregard it, and that can't be held against you if you're right. That's a constitutional violation, violates your First Amendment rights to hold that against you running for office. I'm not understanding the difference between that and residency and paying taxes and the other things you have to do in order to be a qualified voter. If it's okay under the First Amendment for you not to comply with one as a matter of protest, why isn't it okay for you not to comply with the other?
Your Honor, your hypothetical is so far removed from the facts of this case, it's difficult for
can
me to assess
it.
Well, all I can say is the U.S. Supreme Court has said that choosing not to register a vote is protected under the First Amendment as a political protest. That's what Ms. Val did. That's why. That is the only reason why we are here today. If Ms. Val had not engaged in this political protest, there is no question whatsoever she would qualify to be a candidate in this election. The only reason that there's any dispute about this is because she engaged in a political protest and Missouri law imposes a penalty, not just during the course of the protest, but for two full years afterward. That cannot survive any level of scrutiny under the Supreme Court standards for restrictions on a candidate's participation in the political process.
Now, or it may under not this survive strict scrutiny, but it might survive rational basis.
Your Honor, I don't believe it can even survive rational basis scrutiny. We've pointed out a number of cases that applied rational basis scrutiny to these sorts of restrictions, and they all struck down these sorts of restrictions. In fact, we cited several cases directly on point from other jurisdictions dealing with durational voter registration requirements, and all of those cases, even when they applied rational basis scrutiny instead of the heightened scrutiny that the Anderson case requires and that this own court's precedents require.
Now, your client couldn't have asked in a timely fashion a declaratory judgment, couldn't she?
I'm sorry, Your Honor, I didn't
hear. Your client could have asked for a declaratory judgment with sufficient time, couldn't she?
Your Honor, she could have asserted a separate declaratory judgment claim. We, in fact, asked for the opportunity to amend our pleadings if there was any question about preserving that kind of a claim, and the trial court did not give us an opportunity.
Well, the question in this case is not whether she's right or wrong, it seems to me. But who gets to put that in issue? Who gets to say? If she had been elected and gone to the House and they refused to seat her because she's not been a qualified voter for 2 years, she could have raised her claim then. She could have argued, yes, I am. It would have been decided. If her opponent had challenged her on that basis, she could have made that defense. It would have been decided. Isn't the question here not whether she's right or wrong, but whether the Secretary of State gets to flip the presumption created by her declaration and put her as the party seeking relief rather than the party defending relief, which the statutes otherwise provide can be gotten against her?
Your Honor, I think that I would agree with you that that should be the only issue. If this court disagrees, if this court says, no, the Secretary, in fact, does have the authority that he claims, then we have to reach the First Amendment question. Our preferred resolution of this case would be for you to rule that the Secretary of State does not have this freewheeling, unfettered authority that he's claimed to make judgments about candidates' qualifications. And then, if Ms. Val is successful at the August primary election, her general election opponent would have the opportunity to raise the exact same objection. And at that point, we would then raise our First Amendment defense. If no one challenges her qualifications before the election is held and she's elected to the legislature and the legislature then determines we don't think she meets the qualifications, at that point we would raise our First Amendment arguments. So this court need not necessarily address the First Amendment arguments today if it resolves, as it should, that the General Assembly never intended to give the Secretary of State this vast authority that he claims in the first place.
Any further questions?
Thank you, counsel.
May it please the court. There's only one claim raised in the petition that is still before this court, and that's the question of the Secretary of State's authority. Before I turn to that sole issue from the petition, I have to make a stop at mootness. So we filed our request for transfer immediately after the Court of Appeals Western District ruled and before the six-week deadline that appears in two statutes. One statute the court has been discussing earlier today, it says that someone can't be added to the ballot after a particular point. You could read that statute to accomplish its ultimate objective, which is to fix the ballot for 6 weeks, both for the benefit of those who do absentee ballots and for those who are printing ballots. You could say, well, that would apply to taking someone off as well. But in fact, I think I've had passed to the court section 115.379.2, which says that once if there's a disqualification after 5 o'clock on the sixth Tuesday, which was June 24th, then the person remains on the ballot and explain what happens after that point. And it's the secretary's view that that's what happened. What should happen here is that Ms. Vallow does remain on the ballot. This contemplates, there could be various kinds of disqualifications within the 6 weeks. The Department of Revenue determination could come late enough that that was adjudicated in the 6 weeks. An election contest could be adjudicated within the 6 weeks. I mean, there are various things that could happen within the 6 weeks. And the legislature has decided that once we're beyond that point, this is the way that it happens, that she remains on the ballot. If she wins, at that point, she doesn't actually go on the general election ballot, and the party committee can then appoint someone. But let me turn then to, and then the question of whether this is moot depends on how you want to look at it. If you look at it as the only question before the court is whether she goes on the ballot, then that statute resolves it, and it is moot, albeit after the Western District decision has now been vacated.
Mr. Layton, why isn't that right? I mean, you're not going to, if we were to dismiss this case today without opinion, by order,
she would remain on the ballot.
You're not going to take her off the ballot. You can't.
Yes.
I know of no statute allowing you to take her off the ballot.
Well, but let me say that is true, but there are still two ways to look at this and why you might still reach this issue that was pled. The first is the exception to mootness, as Judge Russell was asking about earlier. This is something that is likely to recur and is of some importance. That is the Secretary's authority. The Secretary handles hundreds of filings every year and, frankly, needs guidance now that someone has challenged.
Under your view, would the Secretary of State been allowed to keep Senator Bond off the ballot?
No, because that determination would have required some kind of discretion or judgment call. I mean, when you look at, in fact, that's actually one of the reasons we probably have the registration requirement, is that our residency requirement is so broad that it lets then Mr. Bond file for office in Missouri as a resident of the city of Mexico, Missouri, even though he had filed under oath a document in the state of Georgia saying he's a resident of the state of Georgia. Well, if our residency is that broad, then you can understand why we might want this other method also of ensuring that someone actually has a commitment to the state of Missouri, which is to remain to be registered to vote for 2 years in this state, which they can't legally do, and also register to vote in another state. They have to maintain something more than just...
What if the Secretary of State was a personal friend of Mr. Bond and just knew it? It didn't require any...
Couldn't do it. The position the Secretary is taking here is that he can perform what, in our view, really is a ministerial function. That is to take the document filed by Ms. Vallow and to take the document that is the electronic derivation of the document she filed, which is called a voter registration, compare the two, and determine that, in fact, her voter registration demonstrates that she is not qualified to run. That's all. There is no judgment call. There is no investigation. It's not like the clerk in the Western District case who's out there going to the place that's saying, oh, this is a place of business. They can't possibly live here. No, this is a yes, no answer. It's really no different than, is this candidate old enough to run? Is this candidate a citizen of the United States, as demonstrated by this?
What if they filled out some paperwork and said they were old enough to run? Then it'd be okay to search the Department of Vital Statistics records.
Well, we aren't taking that position. The Secretary here is acting solely...
In this case. You're not taking that position in this case.
No, that's true, because that case hasn't arisen. We're taking the position solely that where the General Assembly has assigned the Secretary of State to compile and maintain a set of records, the voter registration records, that the Secretary is allowed to look at the records that he has been assigned to maintain and determine whether in a yes-no fashion that means that a particular candidate can run. That's
how,
all we're asking.
But how can a candidate challenge those records if the candidate feels there's a mistake in those records?
Well, actually, the way that it really works is that the Secretary of State, when they see a discrepancy, contacts the candidate and says, is there a problem here? And there isn't a formal method for adjudicating that. It would have to be done through 536-150. But here, that's not an issue because the candidate from the outset said, the records are correct, I wasn't registered to vote. So there may be an instance in which that's a question, but it's not this instance.
You know, if you were in court and you handed the affidavit up, that's self-proving, that's evidentiary of itself.
Yes.
You hand up your printout from the voter registration thing, the judge is going to say, I don't know what this is. Somebody lay a foundation or take it away.
Well, that's true.
It's not self-proving.
Except that the Secretary of State would be able to, is the one who would prove it. If you were getting the voter registration.
To himself. He proved it to himself.
Yes, that is true. But I don't understand what the problem is with doing that, Your Honor.
Well, I mean, that seems to at least be a relevant fact, that he's now proved to his own satisfaction that his records support the fact that he went looking for.
Yes.
And if it had been raised by her opponent, or if it had been raised in the House, it would have been his evidence being assessed by some other finder.
Yes. Correct?
So is there, if not a due process violation, is there at least some reason to suspect that's not the way the General Assembly set it up?
Well, actually, there was a due process violation pled here, but it's been abandoned.
Yeah, I'm saying even so, if it doesn't rise to that level, can we not at least presume that that's not the way the General Assembly set this up?
Well, I don't know that the General Assembly set it up in any fashion. And ultimately, this may come down to the question of whether you can imply from the two statutes that the Secretary can act, or whether there has to be an express assignment from the General Assembly to the Secretary in order to be able to act. And that may be the question. In our view, it doesn't have to be express. It can be implicit in giving the Secretary these two items. But I don't know where the court eventually comes out on that.
And when the Secretary has expressed statutory obligation to review initiative petitions, he doesn't check his voter registration records. He sends them out to the local election authorities to check theirs.
Correct, but that's because the question there is the signature, and the signature itself needs to be checked against the original signature. The rest of the data in the record is transmitted, and we have no reason to believe there's error. I guess it's conceivable there could someday be an error. But in that instance, it isn't just a matter of whether this particular voter is registered there. It's whether this is the voter. And so someone has to actually look at the signature that the voter put on the original registration card. So a different animal than what we're talking about here.
Would your case have been different if there had been no registration at all? If the Secretary had looked and found no registration.
If the Secretary had looked and found no registration, the Secretary would have done precisely what he did in this instance.
Because there it seems at least possible that there is a local election authority record that just didn't make it up there for whatever reason.
I guess that is theoretically possible.
I mean, here there was a record. It was clearly less than 2 years.
There was.
The
yes.
absence of a record, I think, would have gone through the system and resulted in exactly the same action, but
it
may
would have
a higher risk of error than a record that's on its face deficient.
I don't know that it's a higher risk, but that could happen.
But there are other remedies to correct a situation when a candidate doesn't have the requisite number of years of being a registered voter in that district. The primary opponent could challenge him in the court. The general election opponent could challenge that in the court.
Well, that
and then the House representatives after they were trying to be seated.
Well, let me get to both of those. The first two assume there's an opponent. So if Ms. Vowell filed and no one filed against her in the primary and no one filed in the general, then under her counsel's, under her argument here, there cannot be a challenge. There's no way for that to happen. So then what you're left with is the House having to decide at some point in the first 2 or 3 weeks of the new General Assembly whether to seat her, and then if they decide not to seat her, then notifying the governor, and the governor then at some point has a special election. And Mr. Rowland and I have been litigating earlier this year the possible delays in special elections. The result is to have an instance where you have weeks or months or perhaps the entire session of the General Assembly where this district is unrepresented. And for what? Based on someone who is who this House refuses to see because the Constitution, based on the facts that she concedes, bar her from taking that office. It's hard for me to believe that the legislature intended to put itself in that position so that it had to make that call, deprive the people of that that situation, even though it gave the Secretary of State the document on which to determine that this particular person was unqualified, whether it's because they are underage, whether it's because they didn't register to vote, whether whatever the reason may be, if it's one of those reasons that's demonstrated on the face of a voter registration.
But your argument is assuming that the legislature realized that there would be a significant delay and when a special election would be set, and I don't think that
that's a reasonable assumption. I don't know. In the litigation we had earlier this year, it became rather apparent that the time period before a special election has varied widely over the years.
But has that been true back in the day when this statute was written?
I don't know that. Yeah. We've gone back and looked about the last 20 or 30 years, but we didn't go back.
Who decides the content of the Declaration of Candidacy and what questions you have to answer?
Well, the statute defines what has to be in the Declaration of Candidacy, and the statute says that you are declaring, you are swearing that you are qualified.
No, but I mean, have you been a registered voter for 2 years be something that's added to the Declaration of Candidacy?
I'm not sure the statute would allow that to be added. The statute says what gives the language of the Declaration of Candidacy.
Okay, that's what I was wondering.
And one of the questions that came up was, what do you expect the secretary to do at the outset? And I want you to think about, especially those of you who filed for office when you were elected judges, think about this: where we're headed here. Judge Green and Judge Joyce go over to the Secretary of State's office, and they're both going to sign up. And so Judge Joyce presents her documents, and the Secretary of State then sits there and calls up the voter registration and reviews it to see, is this going to match? Is this not going to match? And they're going to do that for hundreds of candidates? Beginning on the first day, that doesn't seem very realistic.
Doesn't that actually help the other side in the sense that it's assumed that when people take their oath that they're telling you the truth, and that if that's not true, there's at least two or three different ways in this case to fix it?
In this case, there were some ways to fix it, but not in every case. So the question becomes, when the legislature created the way to fix it, when it regularized what had been a non-statutory approach for opponents to contest elections, did the legislature implicitly, because it certainly isn't explicit, did the legislature implicitly say to the Secretary of State, even if when you get this and you look it up, you determine that this person is underage and otherwise unqualified, you still have to put them on the ballot? I can't read that into what the legislature did. Mr. Rowland says it's obvious in what they did, but I can't find it anywhere in what they did.
Could the secretary have gone to circuit court and gotten an order that the candidate is ineligible?
That's an interesting question. I haven't considered whether that would be a possibility. That seems like I can't say that that is impossible. It seems like a very unlikely thing for the Secretary of State to start going out and policing these things in court.
Do you think day in, day out, the legislature has more faith in the Secretary of State making these decisions than the courts?
I don't know the answer to that. My suspicion is that the legislature would have this faith in the Secretary of State making the decisions like this decision, as opposed to the more complex decisions like the bond case that Judge Teitelman referred to, the more complex decisions that I don't think the General Assembly would leave to the Secretary of State to make.
Any further questions?
Thank you.
Thank you, Council.
Your Honors, ultimately what this court is called on to do when it comes to the statute, section 115.387, it has to determine the intent of the legislature. It's not sufficient for the secretary to say, well, you know, we could shoehorn what we want to do into the language of this statute. The court's responsibility is to figure out what did the General Assembly intend. And if you look at the statutes dealing with challenges to candidates' eligibility, the General Assembly makes really clear when a government entity is authorized to raise a challenge, to judge a challenge, and it spells out in great detail the procedures that are supposed to take place, the timelines within which it's supposed to take place. The Secretary actually confirmed in his brief the vast powers that we suggested he was claiming. He says the only timeline that he's accountable for is the deadline to certify the names. That means, as I pointed out in our briefs, that it's possible a candidate could not even know that they are being challenged until more than a month, or rather more than 2 months, after the statutory deadline has passed for an opponent to challenge their qualifications. That would leave almost no opportunity for a candidate to come to the courts and seek a remedy for circumstances in which the secretary has improperly judged their qualifications. I submit, if you look at the other statutes in Chapter 115, you can very clearly glean that the General Assembly, when it intends to convey authority to judge candidates' qualifications, leaves no ambiguity. That should factor into your assessment of whether the General Assembly intended for the Secretary to have this vast authority that they've claimed. Additionally, I wanted to point out that the Secretary's arguments disclose a marked lack of faith in the courts. They're suggesting that the judicial process is somehow inadequate to address potential issues that may arise with candidates' eligibility. They're suggesting that the secretary has to go and evaluate every single candidate's
qualifications. What about the situation where there's no primary or general election opponent?
In that case, the Constitution gives the responsibility to the General Assembly to make the decision.
There's nothing to do with the courts, and he's not suggesting courts are inadequate there. He's saying there is no alternative.
In that case, he's suggesting the General Assembly is inadequate to judge for itself the qualifications of its members. This is the system that the people of Missouri designed. They gave the General Assembly that authority to judge the qualifications of its members. Acting through the General Assembly itself, they gave the Department of Revenue the authority to judge whether a candidate was delinquent in their taxes. They gave the courts the authority to judge whether a candidate's constitutional qualifications were lacking. They did not give that authority to the Secretary of State. Additionally, I would like to again point out that if this court rules that the Secretary has the authority that he claims, this court has to address the First Amendment issue. Particularly, I'd like the court to pay attention to Daniel versus Patey, in which the U.S. Supreme Court was addressing a state constitutional penalty on a would-be candidate, or rather a would-be representative to the state constitutional convention, when the Tennessee Supreme Court tried to exclude that candidate from the convention, the U.S. Supreme Court said this is an unconstitutional condition. You cannot force a candidate to choose between engaging in constitutionally protected behavior and serving in a legislative capacity. Your Honors, my time is up. I'll take any additional questions.
Counsel, thank you. The matter will be taken under submission.